That was the instrumental rumble that got to poor Link Ray in so much trouble. So here we are with David Shipler, Pulitzer Prize winning author of The Working Poor, Invisible in America, and most recently Risks at Right, The Limits of Liberty in Modern America, who blogs at shiplerreport.blogspot.com, who joins us here. And David will be speaking about his book, The Working Poor, at the CCBC tomorrow night keynote for the CCBC's Community Book Connection program. He'll speak Wednesday, November 6th at the theater at CCBC Catonsville at 10 a.m. and 2 p.m. in the theater at CCBC Dundalk. Luis Lorin is not here, be here in a moment. There is Luis Lorin. He's here, a leadership organizer for United Workers. Bikha Pham is with us, director of policy, advocacy, and research for the Federation of Protestant Welfare Agencies, co-author of a number of research and policy publications on poverty, and Dr. Michael Reich is with us, the Daniel Thurs Distinguished Professor of Social Justice at the University of Maryland, who wrote a really interesting op-ed and response to an article in the Times that we are linking to as well on our website. And good to have you all with us.
Thank you.
So, David and Bick, you with us over there?
Yes, we're here.
Good.
I'm here anyway.
Good.
I am as well.
Can't speak for Vicky.
So let me begin. I think that one of the issues, and I remember the book that you wrote, David, we had several interviews on the book, The Working Poor, that you wrote, and we've covered poverty pretty intensely on this program for the last 20 years. But I think that there's a real confusion in America now about what we mean by poverty. What is poverty and how we define it? You know, you have this new report coming out saying that 4 out of 5 Americans will experience poverty at some point in their life. Well, what does that mean?
Yes, I saw that. That was quite startling, wasn't it? Well, I'd say, first of all, there's a very clear definition that the federal government uses. It's based on income during a particular year, depending on the size of the family. So, for example, this year, a family of four earning $23,550 is right on the poverty line. Somebody earning a dollar more is not technically in poverty according to the federal definition. But I think there are a lot of people who feel that the way the poverty line is calculated is inadequate. You know, it's used as a formula that was based on the way families spent their money in the 1950s when about a third of the income was spent on food. And so, you know, it's quite outdated. I mean, there have been increases based on cost of living and a few other tweaks, but the poverty line really is not very representative of reality. There's been some work done, and the Census Bureau now uses something called the Supplemental Poverty Measure, which takes into account different kinds of expenses, such as housing, which has become usually the major expense for a low-income family. And it varies by geography. It also takes into account certain income in the form of government benefits, which are not now counted in determining a family's status, you know, above or below
right.
the poverty line. But, I think all of this is, it's necessary to determine eligibility for programs, but I think it's inadequate in a larger sense because poverty is not just a still photograph. I mean, you can't take a picture of a family's income in 1 year and get a good sense of their living standards, because poverty is also debt, for example. I mean, I knew a guy who had no medical insurance. He was unemployed, and when he had a cavity and an abscess, he'd go to the emergency room for treatment. He had no medical insurance, and the emergency room, you know, they're required to treat you, but they can also bill you, and in his case, he ran up a debt of about $10,000, so that when he finally did get a decent-paying job as a roofer, which took him technically above the poverty line,
right.
his credit was so bad, the phone company wouldn't even put a phone in his house. So you know, the debt carries along year after year, and it's very debilitating in many respects.
And Michael Reich, I was interested in how you pushed in the piece you wrote in the Times for a new definition.
Well, the definition has to go beyond economic. It has to include the social, psychological, biological, geographical factors that poverty in terms of income affect people over the long term. As David Shipler said, we measure poverty as a snapshot, but an extended spell of poverty, particularly in childhood, can have all kinds of deleterious effects on people's health, mental health, education, employment opportunities, the social networks with which they're connected, the level of stress in their lives, which has all kinds of health and mental health effects and so forth. So those things are often hard to measure, but in kind of conceptualizing a policy response to poverty, we have to take them all into account as well. Otherwise, we're just going to be giving people a little bit more cash or a little bit less cash in their pocket, but we're not going to be dealing with the true multitude of problems that people who are marginalized in our society experience.
And Luis, as a man on the ground in terms of organizing, I mean, I'm curious when you hear the definition of poverty that's officially given, how does that relate to the work you do? How does that relate to your own definitions and experience? Well, makes you look closer to the mic there, so there you go.
Thanks. It is very different from the official description of poverty as the two guests before said. You know, it's not just about the food. I mean, there's so many other expenses that people have, like health insurance is one of the biggest ones that most people have and it's really important to make this point about death, that death is another way to be poor, because you can get things but you don't necessarily pay them, and that by the point that you pay them, or you get stuck paying those things that are basic needs many times. Like, we are not talking about people just getting fancy things, but there's a lot of people that use credit cards for basic things as food. So when you don't have enough money need to go to credit to get food, get clothes, get the basic things that you need for you and your family, then you are not necessarily not poor. For many of our members that work in very fancy restaurants in downtown, they don't have the basic needs for them or for their families, but they don't qualify for being these social programs, or they are not officially poor. So the definition is definitely wrong.
And Bick, from your work, your perspective, then I'm going to launch into some other ideas about this.
Yeah, I think that I certainly agree with your two guests, and that the supplemental poverty measure in New York City led that effort with our Center for Economic Opportunity. That's very important because it for one example, it reminded us during the Great Recession that government benefits such as food stamps and health insurance helped to actually keep a significant number of people from dropping into poverty when they became unemployed or had their hours reduced. So it's important, but it's also, of course, important to recognize that no matter where you draw the line, there are so many people who are either impoverished or working poor, as Lise was just mentioning, and it's getting to be such a significant number of Americans, given how economic inequality and the low-wage jobs without benefits and, retiring into poverty is becoming so commonplace in America. So it's really important to keep the keep in mind when we talk about poverty, we're not talking about the minority number of people anymore. It's a very large number of us.
So, and we say it's a very large number of us, I think that we're going to get to the crux of the issue, which I want to talk about. I mean, I when we talk about these numbers, what numbers are we really talking about in America? When they say, when you see one report saying that 9.4 million people are above the poverty line now because they can get the child tax credit. That exists, or that food stamps lift somebody out of poverty. They're not considered being poor because you have food stamps that help pay for food. Michael, what do we mean? But that's what I'm saying.
As David Shipler said earlier, the measurement of poverty is a social construct. We decide for public policy reasons that a certain level of income counts people as poor, but it's not as both the previous guests said, it's not a real measure of people's well-being. It's an artificial construct that is there for political purposes in order to means test certain programs to make them dependent upon measurement of people's income, so that we establish certain people as being worthy of benefits and other people as being unworthy of benefits, going all the way back to the English poor laws. And we do that partly to stigmatize people, partly to divide the working poor from the welfare poor, and that prevents people from getting together to advocate for universal programs that would enhance everyone's well-being. And the other point, just very quickly, is that we focus on poverty. which is easy to measure because we measure it in absolute terms in terms of income. But we don't focus until recently anyway on the issue of inequality. The rate of poverty can drop as it has during the 80s and that part of the 90s while inequality increases. And that's really that's the real issue at heart.
We got to take a short break and come right back to our guests with your thoughts here. 410-319-8888. How do you define poverty? How many of us have slipped back into that world ourselves and have struggled to come back out of it? Your own thoughts and stories at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. We're looking forward to hearing your thoughts. We'll be right back.
That's what you are. Unforgettable.
We do Proud Mary. Rolling, rolling, rolling on the river. Listen to the story now.
Left a good job in the city. Working for the man every night and day. And I never lost one minute.
Proud Mary. Today is Ike Turner's birthday. It's the day he was born. And so we're a little bit of Ike and Tina Turner, but we went out with Unforgettable Nat King Cole. And this day is the day he started his TV show. Before we jump into conversation, I'll remind you that we're having this lecture series start, The State of the Arts. And even though studies are showing the benefits of art learning and tight education budgets, and we're losing art programs all over our schools. And so join WEA and the Creative Alliance. We can discuss solutions at the State of the Arts. It'll be a town hall meeting, bringing together parents, students, arts educators, and others to develop strategies for our own Baltimore area schools. And we'll conclude with a jam session by Baltimore area student musicians. It's Monday, November 11th, 6:30 p.m. at the Creative Alliance at the Patterson. More information at 443-885-4391 or weaa.org. And I'll be moderating. Looking forward to you joining us that night here at the Creative Alliance. So we are here with David Shipler, Pulitzer Prize winning author of The Working Poor, Invisible in America, at Louise Lorin, leadership organizer of United Workers, Bikha Pham, who is director of policy and advocacy and research at the Federation of Products and Welfare Agencies, Dr. Michael Reich, who is the Daniel Thurs Distinguished Professor for Social Justice at the University of Maryland. The number here is 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. You can log on to our Facebook pages, and you can also tweet us at Mark Steiner. So In looking at all these articles in the last few days about poverty in America, starting with a piece that you wrote in the New York Times, Michael, and going over some of these past notes I did with David Shipler's book, this is what I was struck by. You can look at the issue of poverty and go, we have to have this new way of measuring poverty in America. The government has to have a new way of kind of measuring what poverty is and how you determine who is really poor. That's one way to look at it. And as I'm reading these articles, there are a million arguments. The National Academy of Sciences has its recommendations about how you're supposed to evaluate poverty. And then the Republican conservatives come back saying, well, you have to look at all the poverty programs that exist and money going into them. And that should cut down the numbers of people in poverty. And then you look at the divide that does exist. It was alluded to before we went to break, which is that the working poor and working people who are struggling every day just to make ends meet look down their noses and say those people in poverty are lazy, they just don't want to work, and it's their problem. We have no unity with them at all, even though poor people work, as we know, if you've been there, to work hard just to survive and make ends meet. So it's a question, how do you begin to address this? Is this just simply a matter of redefining it for benefits, or is there something deeper here that we've got to wrestle with is what's happening to poverty, and as you put it, Michael Reich, inequality in America. That's this growing gap in this country.
You know, I think, this is David, I think that one way to look at it is to understand that there are often unseen consequences of poverty. Michael, you know, was talking a bit about this, that cannot be measured economically, but are very real. For example, the cuts in food stamps, the SNAP program that just began November 1st and will, unless Congress does something different, will become even more severe as time goes on, can have lifelong consequences for children in their cognitive abilities, their school performance, because neuroscience has been very good in the last 20 or 30 years at documenting the impact of malnutrition on brain development during critical periods, the last two trimesters of pregnancy and the first 2 years after birth. And longitudinal studies have found that iron deficiency at those critical periods, even if nutrition is restored properly later, still carry over into adolescence. Teenagers demonstrate less math skills, reading abilities, spatial assessments. They display some behavioral problems, less attention, and so forth. IQ, you know, is different as a result. So when Congress cuts food stamps, and remember that food stamps are not very magnanimous. I mean, they will carry a family through maybe 2 to 3 weeks of the month.
Right.
And that's it. When they cut these food stamps, I think they need to think about the long-term consequences that are not obviously visible. And I'm not sure that many members of Congress understand the chain reactions among the problems of poverty, how one thing leads to another, to another, to another, with very long-term debilitating effects. And I would add costs to the country. I mean, if a kid is learning disabled and drops out of high school, then the chances are that he or she will earn less money and pay less taxes and be less healthy and go to prison more at a higher rate. So all of these are costs to the society beyond the cost to the individual.
So the question then is, how do we begin to look at this, Michael?
Well, I would argue that even just attempting to say what would be a fair measure of poverty misses the whole point. And this is a radical idea, I suppose, today in America.
Well, but put it out there.
The whole premise that we have to say above this line people are okay and don't need any assistance, but below this line that they do is a construct. I would say that we have to say what do people need for basic well-being and how do we address it as a society? And, you know, to some extent, the Scandinavian countries have looked at that. They're obviously easier to do in smaller, more homogeneous, wealthy societies. But suppose we did that and then said, okay, this is what people need in terms of their physical, economic, social, psychological well-being. And then how do we address it? What would be the most effective way to do that? And then construct a tax system that could and spending priorities at the government level that would enable people to achieve that. It doesn't mean a flat egalitarian society, but we would have a basic well-being that everybody would be able to reach, not only in terms of income, but also in terms of housing, health care, nutrition, a whole host of other things. Where, you know, that would have a multifaceted components that we'd have to raise the wages of people to a living wage. We'd have to support people who, for one reason or another, were unable to work. We'd have to provide a whole bunch of supplementary services such as housing, decent housing, decent health care, and so forth. But that, I think, by arguing, should the poverty line be 3,550 or 28,000, I mean, we're really just diverting attention from the primary issue, which is how do we create well-being in our society for everyone, and how do we narrow this growing gap in inequality, which is not only affecting the United States, but is a global problem as well.
And that's an ideological, political problem, because poverty comes with a great moral weight in the United States, unlike most other countries, because of the American dream, which is a myth, but it's an important myth, and I don't think it's one we should discard, but the myth is that anyone who works hard can prosper. The other side of that coin is if you're not prospering, it must mean you're not working hard, which is ridiculous because of anybody who has spent time with people who are working but are either slightly above or just below the poverty line understands how hard they work. They work a lot harder than members of Congress do, that's for sure. So,
I'm thinking about this in terms also, and I want you to come right back in as well, Bick. Is in terms of what has to kind of push this change. And I mean, when we talk about poverty and inequality, as Michael was just talking about it, describing what goes on in our country, I mean, the conservative and more right-wing force of America have gotten very good at mobilizing forces to push an agenda. that is kind of taking America by storm in many ways because of its ability to block things and get things moving. And then we can get into all the reasons why. But the point is that the masses of people out here in this community in Baltimore or in Washington, D.C. or in New York City that are working against poverty, they're working in community organized people, don't seem to have that same effect. Do you know what I'm saying? I mean, in terms of pushing this, I mean, so it seems to me this has to be, if what Michael is saying is going to become a political argument and push in this country, it takes organization to make that happen.
Mm-hmm. Well, before we get there, I think I want to go back a little bit to the point of how poverty is being created by the accumulation of wealth on like a few people. So when you have that the 80% of people in the United States just own 70% of the wealth that you have, then we can understand a little bit better what is the problem, and then we can take all those divisions that we talk about a little bit. We can take down those divisions, because then you don't have this division between, oh, I'm a restaurant worker versus that person that doesn't want to work, or I'm a teacher, or I'm this or this other person, and I went to school, and that's why it's these other people are not going to school, are not doing what they should do in order to not to be poor. And I mean, those are divisions that are being created in our society. You know, if you go to school, then you have a better future, supposedly. But the reality is that there is a lot of people that are professionals that went to school and that they lost their houses during the last recession because they didn't have health insurance. So now those people are become to be poor, even when they went to university, even when they have all this education. So the first thing that United Workers always is trying to do is unite across color lines, unite across all those divisions that we have in our society that are very clear and that have been used to for us to fight against each other, because then become to be, that's your personal choice. You are poor because you decide to be poor, and not the deeper understanding of we are poor because we are living in a really unjust society where we allow that a few people get like a huge accumulation of wealth versus all the rest of us working really hard and yet not having enough to even cover their basic needs.
And by the way, participation in labor unions has declined so dramatically now that in the private sector, I think it's less than 7%, isn't it, Luis, of workers who are in unions. I mean, that's almost like not having unions. So there's legislation that's repeatedly been introduced in Congress and failed to make it easier for people to organize at their workplaces. And that's a very important feature of the problem.
Let me go to the phones here. I'm going to come on the way to the phones, Bick. Let me ask this quick question. We'll go to Jennifer, our first caller up. I mean, so the work you do and many others do, what we've done is, I think, and this is not to downplay or denigrate anybody's work to address the issues that people face, but with the end of the official poverty program, or the end of kind of putting people to work in America, this has fallen on the backs of churches and nonprofits. And so, and many would say, okay, well, that's where the work should be. But it's really impossible to address the issues of poverty in that way, Bick.
No, absolutely. Our member agencies and churches are very much at the edge of what they can do in terms of helping those in need. And the government, many of them rely on government programs to fund the soup kitchens and food programs and child care centers. And when those get cut, then their services get cut. We're in New York City, and it's election day, and it looks like the main candidate who will win the election based upon the polling is Bill de Blasio, who has been talking about a tale of two cities and about economic inequality. It's the big message from his campaign. And I think with more and more Americans and New Yorkers experiencing economic inequality and poverty and low-wage work, that message is a very, very strong message to these voters. So he beat out candidates who were very much corporate-backed, billionaire mayor-backed candidates, and in order to not even have to have a runoff. So I think that the work that we're all doing, now is the opportunity, now is the time when the public is actually not only listening and not only with us, but ready to actually act. And so it's a key key time for progressives if we're able to put forward some real solutions, and as one of the, as I think David said, more long-term thinking about these solutions, 30 years out, what is it we need to see change, and then start planning for that. And one of the ways to do that is the social indicators, which is something that, for example, Boston developed, the Boston Social Indicators. And it really just, it tracks, it puts together the integrator indicators, as I think David mentioned, about, you know, health and social and economic situation and well-being, economic inequality, and says, well, what are we going to do as a city or as a state or as a nation over the course of 30 years to make these changes?
Let me open the phones here, 410-319-8888. Join us here, write to us at astonishment@gmail.com. Jennifer, you're on the air.
Hi there. My heart goes out to the goodwill involved in this discussion, but unfortunately, all this strife is so exploitable. And I feel like our policymakers and our worker bees and the bureaucrats involved in these solutions or policies are really not dependable, not so much as factors like community or population control, which would allow us to get a grip on these things and move forward on a solid basis. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. Michael?
Well,
I'm not sure I understand her point.
I just like to just
go ahead, David.
Make one point, which is, occurred to me as I was talking to people when I was working on my book about how it is to apply for benefits that they are eligible for. You know, the law, in a way, is made by the receptionists in the welfare offices. They are the ones who screen people, who tell people, no, you're not eligible, won't even give them an application form. And so the, what's called the take-up rate for many government benefits is far below 100%. I mean, it's sometimes, you know, 60% and that sort of thing. So there are a lot of people eligible who aren't getting benefits, partly because they confront the bureaucracy, which is often hostile or so complex that it's not worth it. I mean, for example, you know, if you're working and you are still entitled to certain benefits such as housing subsidies or food stamps, you know, every so often, depending on the state's rules, you have to present all your documents to the welfare office to be requalified. And, you know, that means you have to take time off of work, which, you know, many bosses are not very happy about. So there are lots of obstacles there, and if that's what she's referring to, I would agree with her. On the other hand, you know, there are some very clean ways of providing assistance. The earned income tax credit, for example, and we may denigrate money as the solution, but, you know, as that great economist Woody Allen once said, poverty is a tragedy, especially from the financial point of view. And, you know, the earned income tax credit provides money to poor families when they file their tax returns, if they qualify. And there's no additional bureaucratic mechanism. It's the IRS that just does it. You have to work to get it. So that Republicans kind of like it because of that. It's not just a handout. It's something you basically earn. You know, that's helpful, and that has had a huge impact, actually, on alleviating poverty.
But we have to look at the political aspect of this in a couple of ways. First of all, that the construction of highly bureaucratic mechanisms for distributing benefits is deliberate. And policymakers, particularly at the state and local level, make it hard for people to apply for benefits. They make it complicated. And in fact, if you look at the administration of the Affordable Care Act, created obstacles to people getting the subsidies and the benefits for which they're entitled. So that's one thing. The other thing is, in terms of political discourse, the discourse in our country has been evolved in such a way so that there's a racial wedge that's thrust in between different groups of people who are in need. Luis alluded to this, I think, in his comment before, but we have to recognize that. When people talk about expanding benefits for society, whether they're public sector jobs or nutrition assistance or health care or whatever, the Tea Party has picked up on the theme that we're paying more taxes. Our money is going to them. Well, who is them? When they say cut government spending, they really mean they leave out the words for other people. They don't want the programs that benefit them to be cut. So I think a fundamental era of social policy in the United States occurred probably about a little less than 50 years ago, when we shifted the focus from the development of universal programs, which would be funded by a graduated income tax, a progressive tax, and we shifted it to focusing primarily on means-tested programs, which could be regulated in the way that David just described and to which your caller alluded. And as a result of that, it just fostered this notion of the division of the worthy and the unworthy, and worthy now being equated with white and unworthy being equated with persons of color or other people who are marginalized in our society. Mm-hmm. So unless we address that fundamental aspect of our discourse and restructure policies in a new direction, we're not going to be able to make any progress on this issue.
This is a very important point, and I would just add one quick observation that many of the poor internalize the majority or the upper classes' views of them. So they blame themselves. They regard getting benefits as humiliating. I met a young woman recently who was a college student, but was in her late 20s, who said, "I would never apply for food stamps, never. It's just humiliating." And, you know, that attitude is self-defeating and damaging, but it's one that prevails even among some of the poor.
Well,
Luis,
I would like to add something there. I think it is true that people feel this shame of apply for a public benefit, but we need to also see the reasons why. It's not necessarily it is because society and we create this kind of this shame where it's your responsibility if you are poor and not necessarily looking at the whole picture. So if you are a Walmart worker, for example, part of your training is how you apply for food stamps and for other government benefits. But you are a worker. You are working in one of the biggest multinational corporations that are making more money during the recession than most of other corporations. And yet they are pushing for you should apply for public benefits. You should apply for food stamps. But you're a worker. You're working hard. And yet they are pushing for this thing of that shame people. And I think it is really important to remember that that corporations, the economic system is really tied to the political system. So we cannot talk about just change in politics without talking about build a social movement that really will take the root of the issue. So, for example, if we talk about the Affordable Care Act, more people are losing. There is a lot of people that are losing their coverage because the way that it was set up is not to be a universal healthcare. It's not being to really cover everybody. At the very end of the day, we know that who are getting more benefit of this is the corporations and not the people. So what we really need to push for is a universal healthcare that can come without a real social movement where people are really taking on this. Any political change cannot happen without that social movement.
Vic, your thoughts on what you just heard?
No, I think I completely agree with Louise I think our organization, historically anti-poverty organization and an organization supporting services for the poor, we are moving towards thinking more globally about what are the root causes of poverty. And part of it is about how workers are being treated, the influence on politics, on the political process that are making these things worse and worse for working people and low-income people. And so I think it's very important that many groups that are working in this area start thinking about that. And I would say I agree with what the other two guests talked about in terms of the stigma and the wedge issue. I guess the positive side for me is that, you know, poll after polling has shown that since the Great Recession, more and more Americans are not going for that, biting on that bait. You know, they're seeing their family members, themselves, lose jobs, lose good jobs, lose wages, and have long-term unemployment. So they're starting to think more about the 99% than the negative stereotypes that used to work more like in the 80s and 90s. So I hope that will be a benefit to all of us who are trying to do short-term and long-term progressive change.
So one of the things that I found interesting in a piece I was reading this morning with about the minimum wage, just talking about maybe changing perception in America as like in battle cries, is that when you look at minimum wage, it said if it kept pace with inflation, it would be $10.75 an hour. But in a Bill Moyers piece that I was reading about how to end poverty in 10 years, one of them said if it had kept pace with increased productivity of the American economy, then the minimum wage would be $17.19.
Uh-huh.
And, yeah. And actually, when you think about $17.19, that's an adequate wage to live a life. Something beyond, below that is utterly impossible.
Sure, especially in large metropolitan areas, right. And Luis's comment about Walmart was very instructive in regard to that. I mean, what Walmart is essentially doing is allowing government spending to subsidize their profit by allowing them to maintain low wages and saying, well, okay, if you we're not going to pay you, but the public will pay you through food assistance, health assistance,
exactly.
Housing assistance.
This has been a fascinating discussion, and we're going to come back to this. This is one of the themes we've been talking about for 20 years, but I think we need to push it in this community of ours and in society in general, because I think that there's something brewing, and we have to help brew it, or it's not going to change. And I want to thank everybody for being here. Bickhoff Farm, it's been great to meet you. Glad you're on the show with us.
Thank you.
Director of Policy Advocacy and Research, Federation of Product Welfare Agencies, Dr. Michael Reich. Great to have you. Meet you for the first time. Good to have you in the studio.
Thank you.
The Daniel Thurston, Distinguished Professor of Social Justice at the University of Maryland, School of Social Work. That wasn't right.
That was correct.
The entire title.
Thank you.
That right.
Thank you.
Luis Lorraine, always good to have you in the studio.
Thanks.
Leading organizer with the United Workers, David Shipler, Pulitzer Prize-winning author of The Working Poor, Invisible in America. And recently his book is Rights at Risk, The Limits of Liberty in Modern America. And David will be at the Community College of Baltimore County this Wednesday, November the 6th, and the theater at the Catonsville campus at 10 a.m. and at 2 p.m. at the theater in the on the Dundalk campus. And we will be posting on our website and encourage you all to go there and engage this conversation. And thank you all for being with us.
Thank you, Mark. It's good to
Thanks,
be
Mark.
With you.
Thank you.
We're going to take a brief break. I'll remind you on the way out for this brief break that the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offers a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. Remember, it's a credit union, not just a bank. It belongs to you. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. More information, www.mecu.com, or you can click on their banner at steinershow.org. That's MeQ, Baltimore's credit union. We'll be back with Soundbites, our weekly look at the future of our food system and the environment. Stay with us.